everyone, Patrick Connor here, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm here with my dude, Aris Pina, who is, of course, a fellow fight history file, just like me, and a CompuBox operator. Aris, what's up, man? How you doing?
Everything is good, my man. We're delving into another subject I'm really excited about. It's one that's, you know, a guy who's kind of been lost to time a little bit, but so we're going to bring him back right now. You know, it's going to be a good time. Everything else is good. Big fight weekend coming up. Lots of other fights coming up. News always. You know, things are good.
You know, you got to, well, we'll get to the subject at hand in just a moment. Like you alluded to, we've been doing some true crime podcasts. So we've done a few of them already. And today we're going to be doing another one. And the subject, and I don't mean to say that callously, but a young man named Tyrone Everett from Philadelphia who wound up getting gunned down in 1977. But before we get to that, I was just going to say, dude, you got to attend the big AEW show last night in New York.
Oh my God, how was that? Dude, it was the best time of my life. Are you kidding me? That was amazing. The first match out the gate, like I got to credit Corey Erdman for this one, actually, our buddy Corey. Because I was at work and I was contemplating going to it. Like, I was just going back and forth, but I didn't know really if I was going to be tough out of work, getting out of there, figuring out I was going to get there really quick, running back. It was always just my mind's always racing, and being a person with anxiety, you know, logistics, things, think too much about it. But then he finally messaged me out of the blue that day, and he was like, you probably should go to Danielson Omega. And he just sent me a ticket chart out of the blue. He said, you know, with a ticket sheet thing. About, like, I guess new seats had been opened up, and I was like, you know what? I really should. What am I doing with myself? So I looked at the thing. I was like, I'm going to spring for a decent size, decent price ticket. And the seats I had were incredible, bro. Like, I was one level up from the floor, right there, perfect zoom lens view right to the ring. Couldn't miss a thing. And it was just, that was beautiful to watch. The whole card up and down. I was excited from the beginning to end. I lost my voice. Everybody else around me was losing it themselves. And I just got to see some incredible action, dude. As a wrestling fan myself, who actually saw Andre the Giant in person when I was a little kid, that shows you how far back I go. I've been jaded over the years. You know, WWE sucks for me, at least. I know there's a lot of fans out there who like it, but it's not for me. And AEW has been a breath of fresh air, and they've gotten even bigger now and just better. Even as they've evolved, they've added more people, the way they've kind of found their footing or where they want to go with this. It's incredible. And I love it. And I'm just, you know, the fact that I had a chance to see Danielson yesterday, CM Punk, Kenny Omega, the Young Bucks, Adam Cole, you know, and the list goes on. Sting. Like, I was incredibly excited to see Sting, man. I've been a Sting fan since 1991, you know, and to finally see him live, even though he's 62, like, he still got it too. He could still move around and do some shit. Like, it was awesome to watch, man. So that was just an incredible experience. I'm very, very glad I went out there, and I'm incredible. You know, something I'll always have with me that I got a chance to watch that live. That was cool. I'm definitely going to go be back to other events. They're supposed to be there in Long Island in the beginning of December. I'm already looking for tickets for that one, and anywhere else I can travel for somewhere big, I will definitely be there.
You know, between AEW and some of the stuff that New Japan Pro Wrestling is doing, some of the other smaller organizations and stuff like that, I'm not going to pretend to know more than I know and be a wrestling fan when I'm not a massive wrestling fan, but it just sounds like there's a lot of really exciting stuff going on. And that's cool that you got to see one of the first new shows, or one of the first big shows since the pandemic started, because everything's been canceled.
Absolutely. They've gained a lot of momentum since then. WWE got rid of a lot of guys that AEW picked up and were just like, hey, we'll actually use you. And these people are excited because AEW gives you the chance to actually be yourself. You're not just being controlled by, you know, robot, like a bunch of yes men and other people at WWE where it's so corporate and the atmosphere sucks and everyone complains. How do they kind of just either water you down or don't allow you to be your true self? And AEW is kind of like, you know, be who you want to be out here and we'll just go with it. It's really awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. And like I said, that's awesome you got to actually go. It sounds like it was really exciting and a whole lot of fun. That's cool.
Oh, man, it was an absolute blast. I couldn't agree. I was just very excited to be there, very excited, happy to experience that with all those other fans around me. It's a wonderful atmosphere, man. Just something that I haven't felt like that since I was a kid. You know what I mean? Like, this, that type of excitement. So we're going to keep on riding that momentum.
Totally.
It's like total nerd shit, man. Like, everyone's like, oh, you like wrestling? I'm like, yeah, I like wrestling. It's awesome. Just let yourself be for a couple of hours and don't get, you know, just follow with it. It's awesome. People take literally and seriously sometimes.
Well, and I mean, it's really not that far from any combat sports in general. I mean, they're all like cousins of each other in the first place, but I mean, they all have some significant amount of silliness or ridiculousness. It's pretty tough to ignore it. And boxing's like literally no exception. I would say that today is not the silliness or some ridiculousness for sure, but not so much silliness, but there's so much stuff that goes on in combat sports that wrestling might not be my thing, but I can't really get mad at anybody for, you know, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Being a boxing fan, I feel pretty hypocritical getting mad at people for being wrestling fans or MMA fans or something, you know.
Most people that are boxing fans do like wrestling or will watch and stuff like that, even if they won't admit it sometimes, but lots of them will be wrestling fans. It goes both ways.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, to the subject at hand here, to the true crime. Of course, true crime in the last handful of years has gained a big following, podcasts, TV shows. I know you love some of those TV shows.
Dude, I'm an ID Discovery junkie to the point where I don't even know if I can watch it anymore because I've seen everything. It's one of those. I don't like serial killers. I'm not one of those, but
yeah, everyone in my family is big on true crime and history and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So I don't have a
burden. A lot of it's interesting and fascinating, especially like gang stuff, mafia stuff, whatever. You know, it's a lot of interesting stories there.
Yeah, well, and gang and mafia stuff kind of does figure into
hand in hand with boxing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It goes hand in hand with boxing and has since pretty much the beginning. You know, I talk about it a little bit. Quick plug for my book, Shot at a Brothel. I talk definitely about some mafia stuff, not only pertaining to Oscar Bonavena specifically, but I also kind of go briefly into the history of some mafia involvement in boxing and stuff like that. And in any case, there's such a massive history of those two things, boxing and crime, boxing and true crime, that it's like really a natural.
Dude, you can't beat it. It's with all the various stories that go on in boxing over the years and crazy things, and half of them don't even scratch the surface. There's a few of them that, you know, obviously, you know, that people have known over the years, made big news, like Frankie Carbo, the IBC. The way they like basically just had Jim Norris as their puppet while they ran boxing, Blinky Palermo, all that stuff. That's well known. You know, you're moving on into the 70s and 80s, Don King and his shenanigans, Harold Smith, aka Ross Fields, with embezzling Wells Fargo and stealing over $20 million out of there. Like, there's always been some kind of stuff all the way back to the turn of the century, when it was, you know, referees and other people were easily bought and fights were fixed and other stuff like that for profit. Like, boxing and crime and, you know, underground stuff go hand in hand. It's one of those sports that embrace it, anything. More than any other sport, corruption and everything running amok, where you can just kind of go and just dip your toes in it and make a lot of money just by being a bad character and doing funky stuff. Well, join the boxing world.
A lot of people might be anybody familiar, or at least just kind of briefly familiar with Tyrone Everett's case, might be thinking like, mafia, what are you talking about? What does that have to do with anything? Because if you kind of skim over what happened to Tyrone Everett, I think that the main takeaways are going to be that he was shot by his girlfriend, his live-in girlfriend, we'll get to that in a minute, but he was shot by his girlfriend and killed by his girlfriend for being caught sleeping with another man who was at the time dressing as a woman.
Yep.
And that's kind of like the main takeaways. If you're looking at any articles or headlines or anything like that, you know, that are kind of going to give you an easy or brief synopsis of what happened. But when I started looking into it, I mean, I'm not trying to suggest I'm busting any sort of case or breaking anything open, but it seemed to me that there was a lot more stuff going on than that. I mean, as there pretty much always is.
Yeah, when you look into the story like this, bro, like at the surface, it just seems like a disgruntled lover walks in on her man cheating, gets very angry about it, sees the pistol over there, in the heat of the moment, pulls it, shoots him, kills him. It's happened many times. Half the time you see that on ID Discovery. That's how I watch these things, you know. Usually on that show, Snapped. Okay, but back to kind of long. And, but that's not, that wasn't just the case. At the surface, that seemed like it, but there are tons of layers that went down to that, down to how this whole unfolded. Exactly after the immediate aftermath of the shooting, when the disgruntled lover and the person that Tyrone was sleeping with took off together, and the person that was like tried to help him out, like there's so many different things, and then you find out, you know, all the drugs on the side, and there's a lot to this case. All right, just much more than what was on the surface of just seemed like someone got shot because she was pissed.
So as just about anybody who follows the podcast when we do history stuff, and of course has listened to either of the true crime podcasts we've done, one of the things I just really like to do is I like to try to go as wide as possible when it comes to the history stuff, or just at least figure out more of the why or how stuff happened, set a bit of a backdrop, provide some background, all that type of stuff, because that's important to the story, but it's also important to kind of understand the situations and conditions that these people who were involved found themselves in, basically. So at the height of the civil rights struggle in the U.S., in the late 1960s, an organization called the Black Mafia basically rose to power in and around Philadelphia. So Camden, Atlantic City, like South Jersey, and this Black criminal organization, or predominantly Black criminal organization, began engaging in activity that would be generally associated with gangs, mobs, stuff like that. Anything from low-level extortion to drug trafficking and control of gambling around town. You know, things that generally speaking are going to be controlled by organizations, not by like two people or something. And so anyway, long story short, as far as the Black Mafia around this area goes, one of the first major deaths tied to this organization was a younger man named Robert Swint. He was at the time 17 years old, and his older brother Nathaniel Swint was also shot at the same time, but he wound up living. He had a shot in the liver, I think they had said, and he lived. But remember the name Swint, because it's a little bit more important to this story in a minute here. And in the early 1970s, a member of the Black Mafia, a guy named Ricardo McKendrick, was arrested for selling heroin. And so in 1973, he was a suspect in the beheading of a fellow Black Mafia member named George Bo Abney. And at some point he married a young woman named Carolyn McKendrick, and he wound up going to prison until about 1976. But that kind of sets a little bit of a background for the person who shot Tyrone Everett. But meanwhile, Tyrone Everett, who was definitely very well known in Philadelphia, I mean, you take it away on the boxing part, because he was very well known in the neighborhood.
Ty the butterfly is what they called him. You know, that's what that says the story goes, and all the young girls in the neighborhood would be calling him as he would be jump roping around. Ty the butterfly, they would be cheering him on. Turned pro at the age of 18, you know, all the way back in the early 70s. And at that point, Philly, you know, I would have to say it was on the cusp of, it was like a new generation starting to come up. You know, you had from the late 60s, the guys like Kitten Hayward, and others who were really, you know, the cusp of the main guys of the Philadelphia team that you would see on the Gillette Network and others, and just, you know, tearing it up. And when Tyrone Everett came on the scene, he was a part of like the newer generation, as guys like, well, along with Benny Briscoe, who of course was a mainstay in Philly for many, many years, and possibly probably the most loved fighter maybe ever from Philadelphia. So from that era, when Tyrone Everett turned pro, he became a mainstay at, you know, the Philadelphia Spectrum. That was J. Russell Peltz, the Hall of Fame promoter's playground up there. And he developed into a very, very hot prospect. You know, Everett was a beautiful fighter to watch at that point. Very fluid, skilled, could do whatever he needed to do. And he built his record against very tough guys. Peltz has never been the type of person that's going to baby you. You know what I mean? He has always been known to put his fighters in tough. Philadelphia fighters have always come in tough. They've always been bred tough and everything like that. So Everett wasn't, you know, no different. And especially back in the early 70s into the mid 70s, the junior lightweight, featherweight divisions were all very deep. Even the guys who had bad records, so to speak, that everyone would be shitting on today because, oh man, if you got a 25 or 13 record, you can't be good. No, a dude like that would still can knock your ass out. All right. And on a good day, probably could. Because they were all tough. They were always built tough. And everybody fought each other back then. And Everett was no different. And he built his record up against tough guys. He fought, you know, Ray Lenny III, whose father was a very prominent contender back in the day before him. And then went on to challenge Alfredo Escalera. There was another fighter by the name of Hyun Chi Kim, who was, you know, who only had one loss at the point. And was another fighter that Tyrone Everett had conquered. So basically what I'm trying to get is that he turned pro at the age of 18. By the time he challenged Alfredo Escalera, he was 34-0 and a major, major popular fighter in Philadelphia, to the point where they were able to coax Escalera to come to him and challenge him for the championship, that Everett was able to challenge him for his title in Philly at the Spectrum. And for Escalera to be able to do that, obviously he was going to be paid well. And I'll let you take it for Escalera if you want to talk about him. But to say the least, he was a very exciting fighter, a very exotic fighter too, because in the mold of, I would say, someone like Badlan Siki, he would come into the ring with a boa constrictor wrapped around his neck, which is intimidating in itself the way it is, dancing around to salsa music because he was there, and just a tough overall guy. Maybe not the guy that you would think of, like, you know, the most skillful looking guy when he gets in the ring, but he was able to get the job done, a very respected champion at that point, and he had made a number of defenses against credible opposition when he was getting ready to fight Everett in Philly.
Yeah, he was definitely something of a road warrior, too. He'd fought in Japan. He'd fought in Venezuela. He fought in Italy. I mean, and he was the kind of fighter who took on just about all comers, too. And like you said, this was a really good era for right that little chunk from like about featherweight to lightweight and even up to 140 pounds. And it even got better really into the late 70s and early 80s. Something we have to kind of remember is that Tyrone Everett was only 24 when he died. He was really young and he had almost 40 fights anyway.
That's what I was going to say too, is that like guys back then, they turned pro early. And when they turned pro early, they also fought like a guy like Everett fighting in Philadelphia, coming up in that circuit, he wasn't going to be matched easy. You know, if you look at his record, you go on BoxRec and look at it, a lot of those guys, again, some of the records you're going to see, they might not be so great, but they were all very tough gatekeepers, either fringe contenders or contenders, and they all had good wins on their records too. And Everett was able to school a lot of them. You know, he had a very good, like, there's not a lot of footage on Everett. That's the thing. If you go on YouTube, if you go to the other sites, Daily Motion, other torrent sites, whatever it may be, there's nothing really out there. The only fight that's out there is the fight right after Everett's, we'll get to it. I don't really want to spoil exactly what we're going to get to with the Escalera fight, but Everett's fight after Escalera. There's a footage of that one on YouTube, but even that one's pretty grainy and kind of like hard to watch. And there's a little bit of some other stuff, but it's, you know, it's unfortunate that a guy as talented as him, there's not a ton out there to really go with it. It almost adds more to his mystique, I suppose.
You said it earlier that Philadelphia was really a special place during this time. You know, J. Russell Peltz, who himself, he just came out with a book that I'm going to have to pick up. Mm. But he, at right around this time, was, you know, just about it. I don't know if I want to insult him by saying he was at the height of his, you know, there was a lot of work done, always being done. But the Spectrum, Blue Horizon, the arena, this was like in the latter days at the arena. You know, Philadelphia was a big fight city around this time. And so Tyrone Everett was I don't want to call him a leader or anything like that, but he was definitely seen as a front runner in terms of popularity with Philly fighters. You said he was very popular around the neighborhood. He wasn't just popular with women too. Oh, he was popular like with young kids who looked up to him and were like, oh, you know, I want to be like him, because he was excelling as a professional and doing really well.
And he was successful too as a person. Like, what people would always talk about, he owned apartment buildings, he drove a Cadillac. Like, you know, he had money at a time when a lot of people were in Philadelphia would be struggling, and a guy from the neighborhood who's really becoming a great pro, really popular and having money and doing things, you know, that is someone to look up to. And from there too, like, I've always would make quotes too. Like, he would say, you know, I would dream every day about becoming a world champion. That was like one of his biggest goals. But he would also say too that he was in boxing to make money. That was the bigger thing. He wanted to be a money maker, and he wanted to see how much he can make and go from there. And for a person, and I guess I'm alluding to something we'll talk about later, for a person who during that time as a junior lightweight in the 70s, even as a champion, you're not going to be making major purses, you know, the type that's going to be able to like afford Cadillacs and buy apartment buildings and stuff like that. So,
well, and that's why they were fighting that often. That's the whole point. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of the other part of the equation that a lot of fans don't kind of realize when they talk about fighters fighting less often these days, but I want them to get paid well, and I want them to get taken care of. Mm-hmm. And then when that happens, they only need to fight two, maybe three times a year tops if they're getting paid well and taken care of. And that's not to say that you can't make a good living or couldn't make a good living at that time. But for the most part, if a fighter was fighting 4, 5, 8 times a year, it was because they needed the money. And so at least in theory, Tyrone Everett was no exception, but nonetheless,
the fact that you can rack up 37 fights in a matter of 6 years, and he was very active at that time too, especially earlier in his career when he was fighting at least once a month, if not more.
Yeah, he was, and he, like you said, was being matched pretty tough. And yeah. So during his frequently,
always in Philly.
Yeah, he was a Philly sensation. Yeah. And at some point along the way, I wasn't able to pin it down. At least I didn't see it, but at some point along the way, Tyrone Everett winds up hooking up with a young lady named Carolyn McKendrick. And they wound up, according to Carolyn and according to a couple other people, spending something like 4 or 5 nights together in this house in Philadelphia. Carolyn's mother lived a few houses away. And anyway, basically, they had a fairly tumultuous relationship. It would later come out by a number of different people would testify at the trial that they did not have a very nice relationship, that it was frequently wrought with arguments, if not physical fights, and that there might have been some other outside involvement with one or both of them, with, like I had kind of alluded to opening up the show, the Black Mafia in Philadelphia. And there's also right around this time in the 1970s, needless to say, when it comes to gangs and mobs and stuff like that, there's always going to be some sort of pushback or some sort of going head to head from one gang then to another or something like that, especially when a lot of these gangs, including in Philadelphia, were turf based. And I'm not trying to like profess that I'm like some sort of gang expert or some shit, but you know, I feel like it's a pretty remedial concept. The idea of a gang or a mob or something like that staking a claim on a neighborhood, and they're basically saying, well, here's the boundary of our neighborhood and this is our shit, you know, and if you ease up in our neighborhood, people are going to get shot or whatever the case might be. And so, for instance, the Black Mafia had a feud going on in particular with a gang called the 20th and Carpenter Street Gang. And they were based off of 20th and Carpenter Street, which is in, I think, South Philly. And anyway, right around this time, so there was a lot of violence going on in the city around this time, a lot of gang violence that was attributed to the Black Mafia. And so when you start looking into a number of these names in the Black Mafia, the name Swint figures in pretty heavily, and Swint is Carolyn McKendrick's maiden name. Pretty much, you know, just about everybody with the Swint name right around this time that was involved in the Black Mafia has some sort of relation to her, whether cousin, half-brother, brother, etc. So that's where a lot of this starts kind of like crossing paths when we're asking questions about how in the hell could Tyrone Everett, being a good fighter, but definitely not like a premier fighter that's fighting on network television or a closed circuit TV all of the time, how could he afford to be owning several businesses, and how could he afford to be rolling around with the dough that he was? And, you know, questions start, the answers to these questions start seeming a little bit more straightforward, I think, the more you look into it.
Yeah, exactly what you just said. You know, there was a little bit more going on at that point, but at the same time, that was not uncommon for people in, even sports figures, whoever it may be, to, as a side hustle, just to make more money, because you weren't making enough in boxing or whatever your profession that may be, that you know, something easy dough that you can do, you get into it, figure out who you're with. And especially if your partner is already into that game, it's very easy to fall into it as well.
Well, we talked about it with James Hughes, the pull of drugs and the pull of trying to hustle and stuff like that, trying to side hustle as a fighter can definitely turn deadly. And that's not necessarily what I'm saying or what you're saying happened here per se, but often when there's meddling in that world, the outcome's just not good.
Just in general, just because of the people that are usually involved in it or whatever it may be, just whether it's involved directly because of that or not, there's something usually can, you know, transpire. But
yeah, I mean, it's just kind of going hand in hand there. And basically where this kind of, this narrative picks up and why we're doing a show on the death of Tyrone Everett is that at one point, you know, Tyrone Everett gets a shot at Escalera, and it winds up being an extremely controversial fight.
Harold Letterman called it the most controversial decision of all time, and a lot of people agree with it. It was absolutely absurd. And the fight's not on YouTube. Again, I tried to look it up the other day because I swore it was at one point. I know I watched it on at one point, or one of those channels I watched it on, but that was years ago and I haven't seen it since. But it's true what they said. Everett, when they ended up fighting, Everett was at that point at the apex. He was ready. He was 34-0. He was the most popular fight, you know, like you mentioned, out of his popularity, he was at his absolute peak. And the fact that the fight was going to be held in Philly made it that it was almost like it was going to be like more of like a coronation, as opposed to anyone thinking that Escalera was going to, you know, it's going to be in Philly now. This is just like a formality. And when it took place, you know, there was a lot of people, just like I mentioned, they were just figuring that, like, you know, the fight, when it ended up happening, it was a complete domination basically by Everett at first. And Escalera was tough. He wasn't that he was completely outclassed, but Everett was in control, especially the first 8 or 9 rounds. It was, you know, Everett was boxing beautifully, and Escalera was just always a step behind him. Crowd was basically in control, thinking to themselves, you know what, we're going to have ourselves a new champion right here. And then some, the tide turned slightly, and I want to say around round 11 or round 12, and there was a nasty headbutt. Everett suffered a gnarly gash, because I think there was a blood vessel or something that popped in him, and it just created a massive, massive amount of blood. Type of cut that, if that happened today, it would definitely be stopped. But since this was back in the mid-70s, you know, different time, different era, they let that go on. And as it went on, Escalera did come on from there. And the final 3 rounds, Everett, just because his face was a mass of blood, he can barely see, he was just running, you know, moving around a lot, and Escalera was the aggressor, but didn't really matter at that point, right? So if when you go to the scorecards and the majority of people that watched it and everybody, the Associated Press, everyone that was around there, all the other press, ringside, if you wanted to be generous, you can call that fight maybe like 10 to 5 or something like that. If you wanted to be generous, you know, maybe even 9 to 6, like 10 to 5, if you really wanted to be generous. And I'm saying that's really, really being generous. And then to the amazement of the crowd, Escalera got the decision. And the reason afterwards, and people are just like in absolute stunted amazement, because how in the hell, not only that it's just held in Philly, that's never a tone towel, but how the hell does he lose that fight? Like, there's no conceivable way, even if you give Escalera every single benefit of the doubt, which there wasn't many of them, but every you try everything you can possibly do, he still can't win that fight. No one could say that. It's like, I mean, you know, a blind person could tell you who won that fight. It was absurd. So there had to be some kind of corruption with it. There had to be something weird with it. Everybody knew there was something funky about that fight. Like, how did this happen? Why could this happen? Everett was in absolute disbelief. Like, you know, you couldn't understand how that would, you know, how something like that could possibly happen. He was quoted as saying the judges scored on blood, not what actually happened in the ring. But there was much, much more that went on with that. Escalera said afterwards, you know, to become champion, you have to hit a guy. You have to hit me. I was never hit. You know, he just ran a lot. That's why he made the fight difficult, but I was never really hit. I'm still the champion. If he wants a rematch, he has to come to Puerto Rico because I need the money. That's basically what he said. And everybody knew something was up, all right? It's just too much of a bad decision for something like that to be able to be on the up and up, because that's just ridiculous. There's no way in hell, even a novice who's never watched a fight in their life can watch that and be can give you a just scorecard and be like, that guy won, meaning Everett. So at this point, and I'll let you get into this because this is your forte again. Once there was some digging and a little bit of investigative work, people that, you know, were very prominent back in the 50s in terms of corruption, mobs, boxing, IBC, were still in their own way nosing around boxing. And were found out might have been hanging around Philly that weekend or that week.
First of all, the Escalera Tyrone Everett fight is definitely mentioned, or I wouldn't say it is now, because it's not like boxing history is the kind of thing that people talk about all of the time or always making lists on. But you know, like in old ring magazine lists and in articles and stuff like that, since that fight, for probably a good 15 to maybe 20 years or so, it was consistently brought up on lists of the worst decisions of all time and the worst robberies and, you know, top 10 robberies and stuff like that. It's pretty common to bring the fight up. And the way that everything went down, because Tyrone Everett appeared to so clearly win the fight. I mean, you know, we see bad decisions all the time. We see corruption, or I don't know that you can necessarily call it corruption, because sometimes it's difficult to say. And often when weird shit happens in boxing, I tend to just lean more towards idiocy and more towards just total numbskull bullshit rather than corruption. People who are poorly trained, people who have gotten by for years, if not decades, on shitty work just because of the people they know or because there's nobody else. How many like elderly boxing officials have you seen where you're like, I know for a fact that person sucks at their fucking job? I mean, I'm just saying. So, I mean, you know,
many of them. Many
it's,
of them.
It's, I just feel that a lot of the time when people cry robbery or people cry corruption, it's just as easily explained by incompetence. That's, I suppose, a possibility in the Tyrone Everett versus Escalera fight.
Nah,
but the problem is, it was just the kind of fight that looked very plainly for one fighter. And so there, you do sometimes get fights where there's like interpretation or like, those rounds are pretty close. And if you score swing rounds and shit like that, but this just doesn't sound like it was that kind of fight. So it was easy to come to the conclusion, even without any of these old characters that used to be involved in the boxing, in the IBC, and had already gone down the rabbit hole of being investigated by the feds and stuff like that for some pretty gnarly shit. Nonetheless, some of these people who had like peripheral involvement in that were rumored to be in town, or somewhere around Philadelphia in that area, during that time. But anyway, it's pretty, I don't know that you can just explain it away by incompetence in this case.
No, it's crazy to think so. There was a judge, the referee was from Mexico. The judge, Ismael Fernandez, was from Puerto Rico. And then Lou Tress, the other third judge, was from Philadelphia. So everyone just kind of figured, obviously, Fernandez is going to go for Escalera. Tress would probably go forever if it was a close fight. And the referee, who knows, right? But that completely went upside down. You know, Fernandez obviously scored for Escalera. That wasn't a surprise. Referee Fernandez scored for, referee Solis scored for Everett. But then Lou Tress, in the biggest whopper ever, scored for Escalera. And everyone was just kind of like, what? And at that point, Lou Tress was a longtime judge. He wasn't known for flubs or making weird decisions or doing anything like that. The fact that he would do it at this point was a big kind of like an eyebrow raise to a lot of people. And then from there, that's when you find out that Blinky Palermo and his henchmen were hanging around, lurking around Philly that week.
So just for anybody who's unaware, I guess, you know, you might have listened to some true crime stuff, but you don't really know too much about the IBC, the International Boxing Club in New York and stuff like that. But in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the International Boxing Club in New York was like the institution that took over for the 20th century boxing club that Mike Jacobs ran out of Madison Square Garden and turned into an institution, turned into, you know, a pretty serious business through managing and handling Joe Louis. And so he controlled Joe Louis, so therefore controlled the heavyweight championship, which meant, you know, a whole lot of money. But then when Mike Jacobs wound up getting really sick in, I can't remember what year it was offhand, it was like 1948 or something like that. But in any case, Mike Jacobs, I think, had a stroke and got really sick, got really ill health-wise. And after that, I can't remember who it was off the top of my head, but another guy wound up taking over and basically dissolving the 20th Century Boxing Club and starting the International Boxing Club of New York, drawing a blank for whatever reason. But in any case, it was basically controlled. This was controlled by Blinky Palermo and Frankie Carbo. And these two were characters with ties to the Lucchese crime family, which was a massive crime family in New York. And so they had this entire shadow operation where they would control the managerial contracts of high profile fighters through other clown ass managers, or, you know, stooges, I guess you could say, people who were not really the manager but presented as the manager. And the feds went after them because they had gotten involved a little bit too much in some physical altercations and because of some other tax shit that they had skirted. The feds investigated them and nailed both of them, Blinky Palermo and Frankie Carbo. And despite them both going to jail and being notorious for their involvement in this, they, for whatever reason, were still able to have involvement in boxing, like, you know, through like secondhand sources type of shit, have involvement where they would similarly not be directly involved, but have like money tied up in the, or staked money staked in the career of a fighter or something like that. And so anyway, in the aftermath of Escalera Everett, supposedly Blanky Palermo was asked about the judges and whether or not this fight was paid for, and he made remarks that one of the judges was easily bought.
Be bought for a cup of coffee. That's what he told Judge. Because Russell Peltz saw Blanky Palermo after the fight and went up to him and asked him, was the fix in? And Blanky Palermo, I guess, was quoted as saying, you can buy Lou Petres for a cup of coffee.
Well, I would imagine that there's at least going to be some mention of Tyrone Everett in Gerald Pelt's new book.
Oh, absolutely. But
hey, I would encourage anybody to buy it. And regardless, that's pretty crazy, though. You know,
it's incredible. And it's known as the most outlandish decision of the 70s. And it's one of the most heinous decisions of all time. And that covers a lot of ground in boxing.
Yeah. Especially in a decade where the Don King's US
tournament happened and all kinds of other wild stuff going on, and just, you know, the 70s and 80s and maybe I guess up to the early 90s were like the really last outlaw years of boxing like that, and outlaw decades, so to speak. And the fact that even still today, when people who are around from that time, you bring up Everett Escalera, and they're just like, you know, because it was bad.
A young, promising kid who, you know, it appeared as though this was, what's that?
Outright robbed.
It appeared as though that this was his time, that this was his moment. Yeah. Regardless of anything else going on, it appeared as though this was his moment for a championship.
So after the fight, they had to have a rematch, or there was at least discussion for something, because it was that bad. Yep. You need to have an immediate one. So it wasn't an immediate yet. I think they each appeared on the card afterwards in the Alfredo Evangelista card in Maryland as a tune-up, which they both won. You know, Escalera defended his belt, and Everett won his fight as well. And then Everett had another fight. And then at that point, he was getting ready to challenge Escalera in a rematch in Puerto Rico for the title. And I don't, you know, who knows at that point, because obviously he was killed before that could happen, but who knows if he was going to be able to get, if he was going to get jobbed or not out there. I mean, definitely it would be tough to get a decision, but at the same time, he schooled Escalera so badly that maybe he would be able to win at that point. And then, you know, it's 1977. So he's in a deep era, all right? He would have fit in perfectly well at junior lightweight and even moving up to lightweight. I could see him moving up to lightweight easily, because I know there was discussion of him that he had intermediate talks that possibly moving up to fight at the time, the other champion from Puerto Rico, Esteban De Jesus, who was the lightweight titleist. There was also, you know, junior lightweight, think about it. Argüello was around. Bobby Chacon, Bazooka Limon, Cornelius Boza Edwards was on up. Rolando Navarrete. Like, these guys weren't, I mean, well, Chacon and the rest of them were already around at that point, but guys like Navarrete and stuff were on the rise too. And Everett would have fit in well in that mix. He probably wouldn't have moved up to lightweight at that point. But then again, like I said, De Jesus was there. Maybe he could have had Duran at that point. Villamar Fernandez. Howard Davis was going to be on the rise soon enough. Jim Watt, you know, there's so many possibilities of where Everett could have went. And as talented as he was, and he was still young, and I know he already had some mileage on his career at that point. Already having close to 40 fights at the age of 24 is a lot, especially when you're not fighting cupcakes every single time. And, you know, it would be interesting to what could have happened. That's another, like, major what if. I mean, his case and what happened and how he was killed and all the circumstances surrounding that is crazy in itself, but it almost overshadows... His case almost overshadows what could have possibly been had he lived, because it would have been fascinating. And he definitely would have been a champion at some point. And, you know, the fights that could have been made in the interim from there would have been really interesting.
With the sanctioning body split and with the IBF coming up not too long after that, there definitely would have been opportunities.
Later. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There would have been opportunities for him, for sure. But before that could even happen, what wound up happening is in late May, the news broke that Tyrone Everett had been shot, that he'd been slain. The headlines, mostly in Philly, but for anybody who's not aware, I mean, some people might not know, some people who aren't around big cities or haven't been to the East Coast, Philadelphia is in extremely close proximity to Atlantic City, New York City, other parts of New Jersey. And so this little area right here often, and this is, I guess, a hot tip for you boxing historians and researchers, but if you're looking for something from Philly, you should also look in New York. You should also look in parts of Jersey, in newspapers and stuff like that. It's just likely that there are also going to be writers from those areas covering those things. But anyway, headlines broke. Tyrone Everett slain. Philadelphia sensation killed. They already knew mostly what had happened. So the newspapers reported that Carolyn McKendrick had shot Tyrone Everett once in the head and killed him and left, you know, bounced out, and then was later apprehended and taken into custody. And so it was pretty final. He was already dead. There was no fighting in the hospital or anything like that. And so the story developed actually fairly quickly in the newspapers over the course of just a few days. And there was quite a bit of speculation, actually, because, as mentioned, a man named Tyrone Price allegedly was with Tyrone Everett. And what exactly was happening, I don't know. But this was all of this information wound up coming out at the trial. Carolyn said that she was running errands for the morning or for the day, and that she had gone and she just happened to come home early. I mean, with all due respect, she probably came home early on purpose because she had her suspicions.
And an inkling?
Yeah, she had her suspicions. No, I mean, I don't know, but that's 100% plausible if you ask me.
Whatever it was, she came home though and said that she found Tyrone in a compromising position.
Well, so this is apparently what she had said later on at the trial when they got her on the stand. She said that she had come home from errands and she got home early, and that she had seen that their bed was all messed up. All the sheets and the covers were all messed up, and that she confronted Tyrone Everett and was like, you know, who you have here? Like, what's going on? Because you look all sweaty. You look like you've been doing something. And who do you have here? And he was like, what are you talking about? There's nobody here. Nobody here. And Carolyn wound up going around and looking around the house. And in one of her children's bedrooms,
found Tyrone Price.
Well, actually, before she found him, found women's underwear.
Oh, okay.
In the children's bedroom, and was like, obviously somebody's here. But then she found Tyrone hiding. And so the initial story from Tyrone was that I was taking a nap in one of the other rooms and I heard the gunshot, and then I bounced out, I left. That was the initial story from Tyrone, who was the lone witness according to the newspapers. But later on at trial, that's what Carolyn had said, was that she had come home and that she confronted both of them. And that basically Tyrone Everett was laughing at her and was kind of clowning her and saying something to the effect of like taunting her and saying something to the effect of, if you try to leave, I'm going to whoop your ass, and that it's too late to leave. You can't leave now. Like, we're already too deep into the relationship to leave. And it also had come out, and I don't want to downplay this, because it is a big part of the story, and also viewing it through, frankly, 2021 lenses and trying to understand it more as a reasonable human being and not a fucking funny murder type of fucking person. On the stand, whether or not you choose to believe her, I guess, is up to you. But Carolyn McKendrick said that she was frequently beaten by Tyrone Everett, that she was frequently threatened by Tyrone Everett, and that other witnesses who were supposedly mutual friends of theirs took the stand and said that they had also seen on more than one occasion Tyrone either punch or slap her, grab her, rough her up, threaten her, stuff like that. And so that was normal for their relationship, and that they had a very contentious, tumultuous relationship. And that she was also verbally abusive to him, and that there was sometimes some kind of back and forth fighting, although you kind of also have to stress that one of them is a fucking professional boxer that is world-class level and the other is not. One of them is a man, the other one is a woman.
Exactly.
And, you know, I of course would never in any fucking lifetime condone domestic violence or anything like that. And so you do also have to view in the lens of looking back at some of these crimes, certainly not condoning murder, but at the same time understanding that some of these situations are women who were in trouble, in danger. And in Carolyn McKendrick's case, herself coming from a family in a situation that is just absolutely rife with not just like petty crime, but high level mob crime and shit like that. So as we started out talking at the start of the show, when you're in that life, you know, whether you've been born into it, whether you've chosen it, been placed into it, whatever, the outcome is like almost always bad.
Dude, you can't play that game and run it and run with those type of people without some kind of, you know, something happening at some point or another. Whether it's going to take your life or not, I don't know, but like something always stupid is going to arise from it. I've even had like a couple of like close situations. I remember just giving like a couple of dudes back in the day that I was really close with, that I grew up with, like rides and stuff like that. And like something almost happened just out of the blue from it, just like on the block, that I just realized to myself, I'm like, you know, just even giving them a ride, you know, down the street, something stupid could happen. Like, you just don't know. And playing with those people, the hostile environments that you're getting yourself involved in and all that. And plus, like you mentioned, you bring up the domestic issues, and someone who feels always on edge because they're getting constantly beat up, or, you know, allegedly beat up all the time by their significant other. It kept, you know, that's all circumstances to create a very combustible environment where something like that is going to transpire. And the way she walks in that day, and like you said, she sees him, you know, all sorts of like sweating and distress. She finds woman's panties and stuff like that, then walks in and starts questioning him. And then, according to her, he walks up and starts about to lay the smack down on her again. Well, first thing she's going to do is she sees the pistol on the side, or something's going to happen. So, and this might be true too, that I don't know. There's conflicting stories that there's premeditated. She knew what she was doing. She was trying to kill him. She said that she just kind of shot in that direction, didn't know if she hit him or not, and just tried to take off. So,
well, and there's also, I suppose, the question of whether or not the witness, whether or not Tyrone Price is even reliable. I mean, it's possible that they were friends or something like that, and were in cahoots.
He flipped on her at the trial, right? After helping her escape.
I mean, whether or not he actually helped her escape, I think might be
open to
in question. Yeah, I don't know if that's really the case, but... So pretty much what wound up happening was there were some fairly interesting things, and also some things that were, at the time, in 1977, treated by newspapers and press as, if you print transvestite, people were like, oh, wow, you know, fucking amazed. And so at the trial, or when Tyrone Price had shown up to actually testify, Tyrone showed up actually dressed as a woman and asking to be called Terry and not Tyrone. Whether or not this was a permanent thing, I don't know. So I don't want to badly give a pronoun here in this instance, because like I said, I don't know if it was a permanent thing. But
I don't know what you're talking about, because that's how they described her in the...
Yeah, I don't know.
For the article, him for the article.
Yeah. So I don't sure. mean to be disrespectful in any way. Mostly just for the ease of telling the story. Tyrone Price had alleged that Tyrone Everett had sexual relationships with several different men, and also several different men who were around the neighborhood known to be gay, I should say. Not like kind of like down low men, as they say, but men who were known to be gay and openly gay in this particular neighborhood. And that also Tyrone Price had alleged that there were other people in the neighborhood who definitely knew of this or knew of the rumors. And a lot of these newspapers had gone around to like neighborhood people and asked, you know, what they thought of this, what they thought of that. And almost all of them, especially the younger ones, had said, oh, we love Tyrone Everett. We, you know, looked up to him. He was a hero. No, we don't listen to any of that stuff. That's just rumors. That's just hearsay. So whether or not it was true, you definitely have mostly a neighborhood who doesn't believe it and who is believing that Tyrone Everett was murdered like in cold blood or something like that. Yeah. But also the other thing that Tyrone Price alleged on the stand was that he or they had sold heroin for both Tyrone Everett and Carolyn McKendrick, and that he personally had a sexual relationship with Tyrone Everett that was ongoing. And then kind of like after that, Carolyn, when she took the stand, said that she was essentially a love slave or something like that. And ultimately she was found guilty of third degree murder. I'm not entirely certain of the exact timeline because, I mean, the story doesn't end here, of course. It keeps going and going.
Does it ever?
It never ends. But I was still surprised at how far this went. And so ultimately, she was sentenced to prison for third-degree murder and went to prison in late 1977. And then in 1983, she actually lost an appeal for her conviction at the Supreme Court. And then shortly after losing her appeal, her father, Matthew Swint, died. And then she actually was released from prison by 1990. I don't know the exact year, but in 1990, a Philadelphia newspaper reported that she was a co-owner of a hair salon called Imani. And then Jesus Christ. So in 2008, her, I guess, estranged husband, I don't really know the status, the marital status, because it's not like specified. And actually it wasn't even fully specified during her trial, because I missed a small tidbit here. During her trial, throughout much of her trial, her estranged husband, Ricardo McKendrick, who had gone to prison, had gotten out of prison by 1976 before she shot Tyrone Everett, but she was still estranged from her husband, supposedly, and not with her husband. And then after she shot Tyrone Everett, her husband, Ricardo McKendrick, had shown up every day of her trial to support her. And then they appeared to be back together, according to reporters. But then in 2008.
Oh, I'm looking at it right now.
So in 2008, her, I guess, estranged husband, because again, they don't make it clear, was busted in what was at the time Philadelphia's largest cocaine bust of all time.
Nearly 600 pounds.
I mean, that's a lot of cocaine.
Well, that's like, yo, that will make cartels jealous.
It's a long Vegas weekend. It's a very long Vegas weekend.
I mean,
you know, just to kind of hammer this home too, just to kind of make sure that people understand the amount of crime that was going on around Carolyn McKendrick. Not long after Tyrone Everett's murder, Carolyn's half brother Nathaniel escaped from prison where he was doing a bid for second degree murder for stabbing a guy and killing a guy, and he was recaptured. He was actually doing time at Graterford, the same prison as Bernard Hopkins that he was in for a number of years. And then very soon after that, like a few weeks, Carolyn's brother, Matthew Swint, was convicted of murdering a man in nightclub shooting him point blank in the head and then twice in the neck. supposedly Matthew thought this guy that he had shot and killed was responsible for killing Matthew's friend over a card game. And afterwards, others said that it was like the wrong guy and they had nothing to do with Matthew's friend's death. Fuck. So, and then last thing here, in the 1990s, Nathaniel Swint was charged with attempting to sell about a kilo of stolen heroin and 9 pounds of stolen cocaine. I mean, it was basically everything around this young lady, Carolyn McKendrick. A number of people after she killed Tyrone Everett, a number of people who were close to Tyrone stepped forward and said stuff like, you know, we told him not to get involved with her. We told him not to get mixed up, you know, stuff like that. And Tyrone had a brother named Mike Everett, who was also, he was also a pro fighter. And not even a month after Tyrone was shot, Mike Everett winds up on a card with Matthew Franklin, AKA Matthew Saad Muhammad, and also William Caveman Lee for a benefit for the, what was it called? The, I wrote it down here, but I navigated away from it. But the Tyrone Everett Memorial Scholarship Fund. It was less than a month after Tyrone Everett was killed. And Mike Everett was actually lucky to get through the fight that he got through, almost lost. And it was not a financial success whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, it just sounds like pretty much everything going on around both of these people was, like you said, a combustible situation. And people afterwards were saying, we told Tyrone not to get mixed up with this girl. And then it sounded like some people in her family were potentially not involved in some of this nonsense and just kind of wanted nothing to do with it. I mean, it's a kind of sad situation, you know?
Oh, that's a very sad situation for all involved. I mean, the fact that Everett with so much promise to his career and the fact that he had all of Philly behind him, he was en route to getting another title shot, and then his life just suddenly ends. And the fact that when, like you meant, you just basically unraveled everything that he kind of fell into. And I'm not even sure if he realized or not what was happening at what he was getting himself involved in when he fell for her for the first time. But sometimes it be like that you don't realize what you're really falling into when you meet somebody and just get involved. And before you know it, you're wrapped up in the game like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Especially when it's the money, too, because Mike Everett also mentioned in an interview at one point when they mentioned the bags of heroin that were found at the scene for whenever it was killed. And he was like, I know Tyrone definitely didn't do drugs, and he didn't look like the type of person that did either, but he said, I'm sure he was fronting people for them, you know, just to make extra money, to make money on the side and just to have a hustle. Everybody kind of did it, and that was what he was involved in at that point. Especially being involved with her, with Carolyn and the crowd that he was getting in with too. So, you know, it makes you think too that if he was going to be involved with that and the things that were going along, if he wasn't killed at this point, at some point, something might have happened, whether it be with the police or something else, and, you know, years later.
Well, and that's why, you know, I don't want to bring up stuff that's like not relevant or make some sort of weird accusation. And like I said, you know, we're not trying to like crack the case or anything like that, but some interesting
very, very interesting stories. But with all the other things that the layers, that things that come with it afterwards is what really makes it like, holy hell.
Well, and one of the things that I was, that I thought was pretty interesting during the trial is that Tyrone Price, when he was being questioned, I pulled this up here just so I can read from it real quick. It's not very long at all. But the attorney said, were you aware of Mr. Everett's involvement with drugs, if any? And I don't know if it was the prosecution. I guess the prosecution would have objected, but the objection was sustained. So he couldn't answer. Did you know Tyrone kept a gun in that bedroom sitting on top of the bureau? Objection sustained. Did you kill Tyrone Everett? Price, no, I didn't. I was standing right beside Carolyn. And then Sirota, who was the attorney, asked if Everett had told Price about his, Everett's, relationship with South Philadelphia's 20th and Carpenter Streets gang, which several years ago waged a successful bloody street war with the Black Mafia to win control of the local drug trade. Price didn't have to answer. The DA's objection was sustained. So pretty much any type of question that had to do with gang shit or drug shit at this trial, they were like, no. So there's, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's nefarious. There's legal reasons for that. You know, perhaps they just didn't want to bring this information into the trial and taint the possibility of getting a fucking prosecution here against Carolyn McKendrick. But I did think that it was interesting. You know, there's also the possibility that they were investigating and didn't want to fuck it up or something. So, you know.
Totally, man. It's just, like you mentioned before, it's just an unfortunate thing all around for everybody involved, including Tyrone, because he was robbed of his career, he was robbed of his life. More importantly, he was still a very, very young man and at the prime of his life. And the fact that it ended so suddenly, you know, so at, so senselessly, you know, so senselessly, it was just, what's, you know, the biggest tragedy out of it all.
Yeah, he definitely seemed to be headed toward the top, but I guess we'll never really know. I actually, the only note left on this is that Carolyn McKendrick might actually still be alive. I couldn't find anything about her.
Anything about her having an obituary excited. I was curious about it myself. She was eventually released from jail, and yeah, I don't know. I think she must, and I'm sure she wasn't that old, you know, that much older, or, you know, around that. She was still relatively young when that took place, so.
I think she was 21. Tyrone was 24, and I think she was 21.
And that was only about, you know, 40-something years ago, so, yeah, definitely she should still be around, you know, barring any weird health issues or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't be going around to...
I mean, I'm not going to investigate to go find out and go try to interview and be like, hey, so how whack were you and Tyrone Everett back in 1977? Yeah. I'm going to keep that to myself, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That's the question for another time, but hey, no, it definitely is it's an unfortunate case, but nonetheless,
it was great that it was a fascinating one that was really interesting to look into, and especially finding out a lot of stuff that I actually didn't know originally when I started looking into it. You know, I knew a lot about the Escalera decision. Obviously I looked into his career and, you know, as an upcoming fighter, but that's what I had mostly focused on. When we started to discuss that we were going to do something about this, the fact that when I started looking into all the layers and the aftermath of his murder, it was, you know, him being killed, and that I was right. Like, holy shit, like, this was one of my, you know, we were messing with each other too, and you found some new stuff. What did you see? This, did you see this? Did you see this? Like, it's absolutely insane, but that's, again, this is what makes boxing so interesting and fascinating. A story like this doesn't take place many times in other sports the way it does. And the thing is, this isn't just one, there's tons of them in boxing. And that's why I'm right on fire, like, telling these stories now, because they're crazy and they're interesting. And it's like, you know, they need to be told.
Right. You know, there's definitely been a bit of variety with these kind of true crime stories that we've done thus far. We've done Charles Newell, who, you know, was definitely involved in his own share of crime and crazy stuff, and wound up an inmate because of it. And then James Hughes, who was getting into his own stuff. But these are all still different stories. And so I'm happy to be telling the true crime stories as well, because there are some other kind of podcasts and some other shows that dip into this side of boxing. But you know, I think that you and I do a pretty thorough job. So, no, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. When you love what you do, it's kind of natural, right?
For sure. Yeah, it's definitely, it's enjoyable. Yeah. I mean,
and it's also too, like, you and I the other day were still like, bouncing ideas and names off of each other to see who, like, potentially can be like other episodes. And there's so many of them. All you gotta do is just open up a magazine and go through like a Ring magazine and go to the Outside the Ropes section, where they would tell you all kinds of wild stuff that I would read as a kid about so-and-so doing this, one getting arrested about that one, and all this other stuff. And it just, and that hole outside the ropes would usually be like a police blotter. And then from there, moving on to like, you know, in the age of the internet, and then you really can read into like some of these stories of guys I didn't really, I was just kind of read like cliff notes on basically. And then you really can get into their stories and like what they really up to. And I'm just kind of like, yeah. Then BoxRec comes on. And when they have their, like, as they've grown over the years and all their subsections that you can really like delve into, and you find these things out with this one and that one. And I'm just kind of like, okay, okay. Like, you know, this stuff is too juicy not to like really just fall. You fall into a rabbit hole with this stuff. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it is
a little morbid, I guess so, but I mean,
it is.
I love boxing. So I guess that's weird and morbid in itself.
Right. Exactly. That's what I was going to say, is that they, since they kind of go hand in hand, that just what that says a little bit more about us than anything. But, and you know, if there are any stories that anybody really wants to hear, any suggestions people have that they kind of want us to look into, I'm always all ears. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to get to it or get to it next, but you know, cause these things, they do take time. I mean, I showed you, like I showed Aris, for anybody
who,
you know, who's listening. I downloaded like, I think a little over 100 articles just to read through, because I'm just sick. That's all. I mean, what do you want? That's just how it goes. You know, when I get an itch, I got to scratch it. And sometimes scratching it means downloading a shitload of articles and reading about it. But no, otherwise we're not going to know.
I do the same thing at 2 a.m., bro. I'll find like, right. I have Ring magazines that I haven't picked up in like 3 years. And for that reason, they're still kind of relatively fresh for me. And then all of a sudden, I'm just there devouring all this new info that I kind of forgot about. But whatever, you know, it happened.
Well, and that's the exact same type of stuff that we're, I guess, hoping to impart when people listen, or in this case, watch now. But we're hoping that people also learn and enjoy, you know, hear new stories and new stuff that pique their interest. So anyway, I appreciate it, dude. I appreciate you doing another show with me.
Yeah, man, this was a blast as always. I had a great time. I'm looking forward to the next one. And yeah,
we'll see what we come up with. But in the meanwhile, look, everybody on social media, we know you're probably on social media if you're listening. But if you're on Twitter, for instance, follow my buddy Aris Pina at Punch Zone Aris. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. Also, if you're watching and you enjoy watching the video podcast, subscribe to us on YouTube. But however it is you listen, also, if you would subscribe on the podcast side of things, if you do listen, that's also appreciated. And Facebook, we're there too, blah 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 blah, you know, find us all those places. But Aris, bro, we will talk soon for sure.
Always a pleasure, my man. Love doing it. Can't wait for the next. Thanks,
everybody. All right, everybody, take it easy.
Later.